This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everyone. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We appreciate y'all taking time today for joining us for another edition of Midrats. And if you are with us live, you've got the great opportunity of scrolling down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find the chat room. It's the perfect place if you have some observations about the show you'd like to share in real time, or if there are some questions you would like for us to ask our guest in the course of the next hour. You can put it right there in the chat room. We'll be monitoring it as things go forward, and we'll be glad to fold that into the conversation. And as always, if in your busy life, you got to leave before the show is done and you want to come back and see what you missed, or if there are prior episodes of Midrats you'd like to give a listen to, take the shortcut and go over to iTunes or whichever aggregator you do for your podcast, subscribe to Midrats. You get what you pay for, it's free, and it'll be waiting for you to listen to at your leisure. And now we're going to dive into the show, and we're going to take a deep dive into an issue that comes up either peripherally or as an integral part of previous conversations we've had with guests on the show. And that has to do with the COCOMs, the combatant commanders, and our national security infrastructure as it stands here as we're entering the third decade of the 21st century. Is it really fit for purpose? Is it doing what we need it to do? Or as some critics have called it, are they little more than what the Roman Empire's proconsuls were? And what do our Chinese friends say? The mountains are high and the emperor is far away. And are they devolved into their own little mini pentagons and fiefdoms who have their own priorities and their own desire to use forces that may or may not be in alignment, not just with the best interest of the individual services, or perhaps our national strategy writ large? And our guest for the full hour to touch on this subject and all its other branch subjects that are attached to it is Mackenzie Eaglin, returning to us from being a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Mackenzie, welcome back to Midrats.
Thank you for having me. It's been much too long, and I'm glad to be here.
Oh, same here. It's funny when you look at how long it's been since we had Mackenzie. She's like, we really should have had her on here early. I kind of feel guilty. But time flies when you're having fun. And needless to say, the last couple of years have been a little busy. But, hey, kind of like planting a tree, the second best time is to have you now. And this subject, I think why it can be so frustrating is because it is frustrating. And just to kind of help set the table, I want to start off today's show the same way that you started your article over at War on the Rocks. And for those that are with us live or have access to the show page, we have a link to it, putting combatant commanders on a demand signal. And this little quote, I think, is great. It says, the Washington Post, quote, concerning the COCOMs, their leaders travel nonstop, oversee multi-million-dollar foreign study institutes and round-the-clock intelligence centers, host international conferences and direct disaster relief, and these powerful commanders are routinely received by heads of state who offer gifts, share secrets, and seek advice, unquote. That was in 2020. Here we are two decades later. Have we gotten any better?
We've gotten better insofar as the problem has gotten worse, arguably. These really are, what used to be the intention behind this was, lean war fighting sort of headquarters, which, as you see in there, I steal from Arnold Panaro and call them these sprawling mini pentagons with their own fiefdoms and power centers and access to basically the military. And so, you know, what I do at my day job is I try to look across the defense enterprise, you know, as the entire package. And what I'm seeing are power imbalances in the system that are really unhealthy. The combatant commander's outsized influence over, you know, the use of force, which the service chiefs, of course, it's their job to train and equip those forces. And then they essentially have to hand them over to these commanders to do, you know, whatever they're doing in the daily churn of operations around the world each day. And the service chiefs don't have a lot of say, per se, in that exercise, I guess, is the point. And, you know, and there are other trends that I follow as well. Of course, the decline in civil-military relations is certainly something that we could and should talk about at some point, maybe not today. But that's like another, you know, problem direction that I'm seeing where the department has headed, and it's only getting worse each year. And that also is about a 15-year-old problem. I think it really got underway in the mid-2000s when the wars were going south, particularly in Iraq, and then it's just deteriorated ever since. And there may be a link, Sal, to these two. You know, the decline in sort of pure civilian expertise and relevance and influence at the Pentagon, and the rise in power and authority of the Joint Staff in particular, right? Because the Joint Staff is in charge of, you know, Congress a couple years ago, you know, gave the chairman outsized, I would argue, globe-reaching authority for, you know, global force management, right? So basically, you know, the thinking was terrorists don't know boundaries. They can go in and out of countries, you know, at will. So shouldn't we not be bound by these regional boundaries that we've drawn for these combatant commands? And but you can see here all these constituencies in my mind are linked. I'm going to stop talking here, but, you know, the decline in sort of civilian sort of heavy-handedness, I guess. It's not the best term, but like a strong civilian leader. The rise in the authority and power and everything else of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs in particular, and that is linked to this rise in sort of a power as well for the combatant commanders. The only diminutive role I see here, again, for the service chief, studied this enough to tell you the direct links, but perhaps they are. I welcome your thoughts on that.
Well, as usual, I have to go backwards because I have to work progressively through this. Let's talk a little bit about how these combatant commanders came about and the difference between the combatant commanders and those affiliated commanders like Transportation Command or the difference between those and what these combatant commanders are about. Can you kind of give us a little quick run through on where that started?
Absolutely. So there are two types of combatant commanders, as you just alluded to, right? There are functional commanders and there are regional commanders. And my article really is, I will be honest, focused on the regional commanders in particular. And narrowing it further, it's focused on Indo-PACOM and Central Command, no surprise. I don't really point that out in the article, but it seems to me most self-evident. We've been, you know, Southern Command and Africa Command have been jilted for years. They're constantly requesting forces and getting, you know, either 0% of those or a very small fraction of them. Right. But then we have these functional commands. Right. So you mentioned Transportation Command, for example, Strategic Command, that are in charge of significant issues and sway and also forces, but in a different way, right? So Transportation Command is basically going to move all of these forces all over the world. Strategic Command is in charge of the nuclear forces in particular, but as well as the no-fly zone over North, working with NORTHCOM, alongside NORTHCOM, for example, for America airspace. So my emphasis has been on the regional commanders because they seem to have the most influence. And, you know, these were, and my focus really of the article, you know, I talk a little bit about how the staffs have grown, you know, as best I can measure it. It's interesting how hard it is to find these numbers. I don't know how much of a coincidence that is, but, you know, I'd peg it at basically 45 to 50,000 people work at these combatant command headquarters, so to speak. And their budgets are not really relevant. You know, they're not that large because they don't control the staff. They control the forces, but they control kind of where they go and what they do. So that's like this weird, you can just look at the numbers of the money and get confused about how this is working because they don't really have a lot of money per se. But essentially, these were established in 1958, time of Goldwater Nichols. You know, these kinds of reforms were all standing up, but essentially it was to focus expertise by a core group of defense leaders and uniformed officials in particular, so that they become these regional or functional experts and all of the people that work there, which is really what you want them to have, right? So that's why they have things like mini intelligence centers that Sal was alluding to, because one of the articles in the Post, fascinating if you read it and reflect on how it has been 20 years, you know, basically saying like combatant commanders who are regional are more important than ambassadors of countries, as in American ambassadors appointed to these countries in some cases, to their heads of state. And because they talk to all of the states and they talk to all of the leaders, and it's really just remarkable. So, you know, it certainly has changed, I think, but in a very quiet but pervasive way over time, to where there isn't really a sense of who's their boss, right? And I think we've seen this in Navy episodes, right? Like the ship collisions in the Pacific and other devastating incidents. There is a sense of like, well, who let this happen, right? Or who decides all of this, you know? And it kind of, you go up the chain of the services, you know, in terms of their service specific chain of command. And a lot of times it does seem like the buck stops at the combatant commander, and there isn't, it's hard. It's a very frustrating and opaque process to figure out who's checking the combatant commander, who's the check on their authority. And I can't figure that out, to be honest.
And I think that's one of the challenges when you try to explain this to people, whether they're in uniform or not. Especially in the civilian world, sometimes people will sit there and blink at you when you tell them, well, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff really doesn't run the military, and the chief of naval operations, he really doesn't control what his Navy does. And they because that structure, the way it works, it's, especially for navalists, and I think it's manifest, you touched on it a little bit, and this is a word that we talked a little bit about last week with our guests. It's stewardship. And perhaps because of the nature of the naval service, a lack of stewardship demonstrates itself perhaps clearer, at least to us, than it does to other people, because you can measure when a ship gets underway. You can see what a ship looks like that hasn't had enough time to just fundamentally take care of itself while it's been deployed. You have that historical record of your standard 6-month deployment, which even we were facing global war at any moment against an expansionist, imperialist, communist empire. But now 7 is considered a short deployment. 8, 9, even 11-month deployments have become rather regular. And you can see where, I like it in your article, you put a nice little note, and it's back to 2015. It'd really be interesting to, because you mentioned how hard it is to get the numbers. But as much as 2015, the Navy only met 44% of the requests from the combatant commanders around the world. And a question that almost immediately comes to mind is, we only have what we have. We know that. But it seems that the COCOMs, knowingly and consciously, and you would think with these huge staffs, somebody would be able to give them the numbers they need, asked unrealistic forces from our military. Is this just because that's how they perceive their job to be, like salesmen, where if you want to sell something for $100, then you need to try to sell it for $150 because they're going to talk you down? Or are they just institutionally that disconnected are unwilling to align what they're doing with the larger national security, not just capabilities, but abilities that the forces have that the taxpayers have bought.
So I think that's one of the issues at the heart of the matter. And let me quickly just define it, since I failed to do that in my last answer, sorry. You know, the technical definition, of course, of the unified combatant commands, which basically it's a military command with continuing and broad missions with forces from two or more military departments, just to clear that up. So I sense there's a problem, and which is why I tried to attack this orthodoxy. I sense there was a problem because the services never deliver enough forces, period, full stop, whether, you know, ships, soldiers, aircraft, anything, to meet the demand of these commanders. And that, to me, is remarkable. And it hasn't changed since the height of the wars, when hundreds of thousands of personnel were deployed. So that, to me, is a red flag. So, you know, for example, when the Army, you mentioned the Navy statistic, but when the Army, who in a time of relative peace, which I would argue is this moment, for the majority of forces aren't in harm's way, right, even if they're forward and they're exercising or doing whatever they're doing. In a period like that, the Army stated goal is that they want a 1-to-3 ratio for deploy to dwell, as in you deploy for 1 year and you get 3 years downtime, meaning stateside or wherever you're forward based, for, you know, schoolhouse training, maintenance, family time, et cetera. And the fact that the Army is about a 1 to 1.2 right now, and we're not, there are not 250,000 soldiers deployed, is a shocking figure. I mean, that's unsustainable. If you're going to use your forces during quote-unquote peacetime or something relative to that, closer to peace than outright war, at the rate that you're using them in wartime, then that's not a sustainable model, right? If I'm in service and that's what I signed up for, kind of the goal, and I'm not living that, I'm pretty dissatisfied. I'm sure my spouse and my family is dissatisfied. You know, and that wonderful deep dive by Megan and Sam at USNI News on the overworked aircraft carrier force was remarkable. But basically, I could summarize it by this. Summarize their very long, more like a research study article, can be summarized by saying the Pentagon's using up carrier readiness faster than the Navy can generate it. It's not even just that it's 40% more this year than last year. That's also shocking. So then the question becomes, so for what, right? And then I talk in my article about how the Air Force has to contract out private aerial refueling tankers because, you know, they don't have enough. Okay, so then you do a quick, like, you scratch your head and you look around the world and you say, well, so what are they doing? You know, why can't the force slow down and refocus towards this long-term competition with China, which is the stated primary goal, the first among equals for Pentagon leadership? And as I say in the article, long-term competition the Pentagon cannot prevail with a series of sprints. This is a marathon, and to use our force like this, we're sprinting it daily and with no breaks. So I look around the world and say, okay, so what are they doing? And, you know, sure, we know, okay, a couple hot spots where there's actual troops in harm's way, check, okay, but then that's maybe under 20,000 total of the 1.3 plus million people in uniform active duty. So then what's with these figures? And that's what I can't get at, Sal, because, again, this is where it gets very frustratingly opaque. So the question is, what tasks are driving the commanders to request this level of churn for the force? And I can't get that answer. And one Pentagon official who just departed the building quite recently, pushed back a little on the article and said, well, you know, the campaign plan generates tasks. A task list, essentially. And I said, sure, yeah, absolutely. I have read the war plans way back in the day when I worked at the Pentagon. They were very boring. It was shockingly interesting how boring they were, actually. And I said, but, you know, the campaign plans, aren't those for hostility? And again, that's where we get back to this issue. So then if there's no campaign plan for the peacetime, then where are these tasks coming from? And I can only conclude there is a perception from these commanders, and I'd have to ask them because I don't know this. This is where the data is taking me, that there's a zero risk mentality. So every problem has to have a solution now, and it needs force on it, and it needs to be addressed, meaning problems short of, again, hostilities, right? And I talk a little bit in the article about the expanding, you know, creep of the term presence missions, which is really what we're talking about. But I want to get to presence in a minute, since you guys certainly have thought about that much more than I have. But the risk, the zero risk, which is impossible to get to, will never get the force to zero, and we shouldn't expect that. But I'm wondering if that's part of the issue.
Yeah, I would think that is part of the issue, and part of your article. I can't remember my Latin well enough to do it in Latin, but the question always was, who will watch the watchers? And in this case, and I think you're hitting it exactly, is who will prioritize the priorities so we don't get ourselves in this mess? We've got carriers doing these back-to-back deployments, and we're not wearing our people out for, what I probably politically incorrect used to call some kind of drill, fire drill, that doesn't do anybody any good. We're just wasting, to go following a Sal's stewardship analogy, we're just wasting assets for no good reason. You want things to be purposeful. But to go back to what I said, who should be prioritizing the priorities so we don't end up with some four-star and CENTCOM demanding that we have two carriers on station all the time, and CNO is going, well, I don't have two carriers to send out there. You know, who's the referee in this contest?
I don't know. I think the chairman, and I, you know, the language could certainly support this. I think the chairman of the Joint Chiefs probably considers himself the referee, which is why he was able to get, not he, this chairman, the previous chairman, was able to get expanded authorities and power using the, you know, these new deployment models. But I don't think that's the right answer. I think that the authorities given, the new authorities, broadened authorities given to the chairman in 2017 and 2018 that touch on this sort of global deployment stuff, need a relook, a fundamental relook. And I really would hope that this returns to the civilian side of the house at the most senior levels, as it should be sort of in the natural system of our, you know, civilian control model. I remember when I was staffing the most recent National Defense Strategy Commission in 2018, and, you know, those are always remarkable experiences because you hear from hundreds of people, you hear from everybody who's currently in the department, practice, anybody you want to talk to, uniformed, civilian, et cetera. You talk to friends and allies and foreign officials. I mean, you just name it, they come through, and most of the deliberations are private. And then there's all these plenary sessions, and you hear these, you know, senior state people, you know, debating these weighty issues, trying to get to a bipartisan consensus. And this issue, the potential for having gone too far with the authorities granted the chairman of the Joint Chiefs was one that they struggled with a lot. They didn't put it in the final report, but there is some coded language in there you can read between the lines that they were concerned that the 20 members of the commission, or was that one 20 or 12? I've been a staffer for so many now, I can't remember. I think if there's going to be a relook, right, we don't just want to get at, I don't think it should just be the chairman independently, right? So I think it has to be a couple of different things. First, we need the data, right? We need better data. And in my article, I talk about how the Pentagon hasn't sent over some of the required congressional reports by law on combatant command staff size, because you can't really, you just got to have good information to start this. We're pretty good researchers at the American Enterprise Institute, and we struggled to come up with the total headcount for combatant commands, which is frightening. So first, we need better data. Then it's time for, you know, we're past time for Goldwater-Nichols relook. As part of that, I think that should include this assessment of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, particularly with the authorities that I've been talking, honing in on here in the last 5 years given to that position. But then there needs to also be, because why would you want to do any of these separately? You might as well make them all one big effort. Then I really think we need a roles and missions review. And I don't mean the kind Congress did in 2011 or 12 that nobody read and it was only important to them and they didn't even listen to their own recommendations. I don't think Congress is the right authority. You know, I think we want the experts in the department to do it, but chiefs are there. They're thinking like this, especially the chief of staff of the Air Force, who brings his specific, you know, Air Force's hat to the chief's job, having just come from there. And this is really interesting because, you know, he saw firsthand the problems with the combatant commanders as TAC Air Force, which he was. And I kind of alluded to that in the article. Let me explain what I mean. And it's come up in different places, his testimony, his vision document as chief, but also in things he said when he was running Pacific Air Forces. So basically, I referenced in the article that, like, it feels like, you know, while the chairman should be having this broad look of thoughtful deployment of forces or not employment, to your point, Eagle, instead it feels like a military Jenga puzzle, right, where the services put in and pull out various parts without knowing the risks. And those risks, General Brown referenced, they could be risk to this, just to the service itself. So like the Air Force is doing something in the Pacific and it solves an immediate problem, but then that combat commander has created a problem in the Air Force's five-year budget plan called the Future Years Defense Program. It could be harming another service. You know, the Navy's doing this over here, and by making this choice, the combat commander then is going to harm the Air Force, who was already flat out because they have a presidential, you know, overseas trip and have no cargo or tanker availability, and now, you know, some for whatever reason, you can just see kind of all these different scenarios. And, you know, and he asks in his vision document as when he became chief, that we need to identify, be honest about, balance, and share risk. There's that word again, and he meant not just within the Air Force, but among the services, and he absolutely meant with the combatant commanders. I think he probably already senses, having been in the job just a few months, there's a fundamental imbalance in those two positions, service chiefs and combatant commanders. So I'm getting kind of long-winded, and I don't want to do that, but the roles and missions review is fundamental to, if you're going to do Goldwater Nichols and you're going to relook the chairman, you know, and you may decide everything's fine. I doubt that would be the case, but I also think that the three, you know, this really needs to be the trifecta. And then there needs to be this roles and missions at the same time where, you know, where basically we identify what it's important to say, oh, there's redundancy or overlap. Do we want to keep that or not? In some cases we absolutely do. I'm most keen on another War on the Rocks article I wrote, which was just say no. I want to know what the services can stop doing, because that is Washington's biggest problem, right? Washington needs to go on a demand signal diet. Washington has an issue in terms of not putting the military on every problem, whether that's not enough border and ICE agents at the southern border and putting the military on it, to election security, putting the military on it, to background checks, putting the military on it, to counter drug flotillas in Southern Command, putting the Navy on it when we have a capable Coast Guard and other constabulary forces that can do that mission just as well. So I want to also talk about what everyone can stop doing. And with that, I'm going to stop talking.
Now, I love that, because one thing that I've put in quite a few titles of my post over the years is I've been looking for Admiral No. But in our structure, it's so easy to ignore your Admiral No if he ever steps forward. And you mentioned two things that I've been thinking around for a while. One's a short-term fix, but I think one is the larger structural fix that we all see. Because you talked about the importance of strong civilian leadership. Yeah, that's our short-term fix, because part of what we have is in our structure we have right now, the COCOMs report to the Secretary of Defense. And you got to have the right man or woman in that job to be at least as a stopgap to be a secretary, no, or at least have a broader picture. I don't know who that magic person is, or even if that magic person existed, how much power they'd have to have. But ultimately, the solution has to be on the Hill. One thing we've talked about here a few times is every 40 years or so, we do a major restructuring of our national security infrastructure. We did it right after World War II. Goldwater Nichols were due. Although it would be great to have, for those that have read up on what Truman did when he was on the Hill, to have some accountability, I don't know who our modern-day Truman, Goldwater, or Nichols is. But as this keeps coming up, not just what with the article you and others have written on it, but the critical mass has been reached, and I think you outlined that frustration as well, where, you know, we don't have hundreds of thousands of people engaged in combat right now, but we're still burning people out. What's wrong? How many more players need to be elected or put into positions of authority up on the Hill that you think on the congressional side of the House we might be able to make what is really needed in the long term? Because I don't believe in the too much in the or I don't think it's smart to rely too much on the big man or big woman theory of where if we just get the right SecDef, everything will be fine. Okay, for 24 months till you get somebody else. How much more critical mass on the Hill do we need to do that big structural framework reference A to give us a better, lack of a better phrase, a better bureaucratic and process to shape our national security structures?
Well, let me just foot stomp, you know, where we need to aim the double barrels here, because I agree that so much of this requires serious work and courage from Capitol Hill, and I'm happy to take aim at my other former employer. Congress is so great in so many ways, and then, oh my goodness, when it comes to defense, it's also getting worse. So, for example, the House and Senate just, you know, dropped their versions of defense appropriations bill in the last week or so. And, you know, the Air Force was seeking, I'm sorry, the Space Force was seeking $1 billion, one tiny billion. It's a lot of money, don't get me wrong, but one tiny billion out of 705, roughly, billion for the department, the way I count it, for the fiscal year. And they wanted funding flexibility to basically move money around that pot to make it include like a basket of appropriations accounts, so to speak. And this is how you would want to fund software, right? Software shouldn't be like one program, one software. If you don't have a shared baseline, then they'll never talk to each other later. You know, this each contractor owns proprietary, so, you know, it gets to be a mess really fast. It's kind of like, you know, your Microsoft Office suite, right? We all use that suite, and therefore that's like the baseline for Americans working. So same thing with, you know, why you need these sort of basket accounts and this flexibility of money. And Congress just, they came down so hard against it. And that is the exact wrong direction they need to be moving, right? On the courage and sharing risk, you know, the last Secretary of Defense, Esper, you know, he was trying to do, so after he did his, you know, Army Night Court, then he did the defense-wide review, and then he did the combatant commander review, and very precious little has come out about that. Trust me, if I could get my hot little hands on it, I would love to share it with you all, but I don't have that yet. Now, he was more focused on money, but the ultimate goal of the Secretary, when he was Secretary, was to reorient basically the time and tasks and people and money of the department towards that first priority objective of the department, right? Long-term competition with China. That's what the scrubs were for. If you found money, even better. But his ultimate goal was that, to reorient the department. Now, that's a big tall order, and I'm with you. There isn't one superhuman person as Secretary who could do it. But again, here, Congress was his biggest issue. So when it leaked, you know, that the Pentagon was thinking about maybe possibly looking at changing some force posture in Africa Command, but he'll freak out. And I mean, I'm not trying to overstate it. Like, I know that's not a technical term, but they basically freak out. And, you know, delegations are firing off letters, they're calling reporters, it's headline news for weeks. And of course, he retreated, Secretary Esper retreated, and they were just pre-decisional documents, right? That doesn't give me great hope and optimism about Congress's ability to look at itself and make changes to its own processes, its own power centers and structures, which again, here I'm looking at you, appropriators, and of course, leadership. It's not the authorizers where I see the problems, the big problems. John McCain, though, you know, if anyone could have helped push, oversee, and really manage and make sure it wasn't garbage, a Goldwater-Nichols refresh with all these other sort of associated action items that I discussed, you know, he probably could have done it. But I will say, in conclusion to this question, that I'm encouraged by the increasing number of veterans who are becoming sort of the leaders of their parties, both Republican and Democrat, and, you know, the Tom Cottons, the Crenshaws, Tammy Duckworth, Joni Ernst, Martha McSally, not all of them have kept their seats. because oftentimes what you find is they are the ones who can talk most honestly about some of these tough and tricky issues. They get more credibility from their colleagues who haven't served, but they can see, now this isn't always true, but they can see a lot of the warts and ultimately what I have found in sort of studying that profile person in Congress, they want to use force the least for any reason, right? Because they've worn the uniform and they've most likely experienced the churn, and many times I'm sure they felt it had great purpose, but I'm sure there were also equally many times where they thought, what are we doing? And so that might be, you know, perhaps it's going to be that cohort. You know, they're not unified. They don't have the same level, you know, they don't all think the same about use of force or what we should be doing or why we should be doing it. I don't want to imply that, but I do think they have a restrained appetite. They understand the limits of military power. And I think better than others, and therefore can look at this in a more holistic sense when the rest of Washington, right, hasn't seen a problem in the last 20 years that they don't think the military shouldn't solve. And I mean, I'm not, you know, as the great Rosa Brooks of Georgetown Law, you know, she wrote that book, you know, How the Military Became War and War Became Everything, as in, you know, like, you know, the size of the staff of the department in Hollywood, you know, like it's just, It's really interesting how it just seems that every problem has a military solution, and I think those who've worn the uniform can see the limits to that approach.
Well, it leads into a question I had. My note here was you had a subtitle in your article at War on the Rocks called "The Customer Is Not Always Right," and the question is, who's going to tell the customer that they're not right? And there you see dare I say this, the brave commanders in the field who don't want to be the whack-a-mole mole. You know, they don't want to stick their head up and get whacked. So they will continue to say can do, which is something that we've said for those many long years that has led to this situation where everybody seems to think the military is the answer, when somebody actually needs to stand up and say, whoa, wait a minute. We can do that here, place X, but that means we're going to cut ourselves short in place Y. And it seems to me that you point to the national defense strategy as something that the go by, which we the military and the leadership of the military ought to be focusing on as to what they're asking the military to do. Kind of walk through that. What does the national defense strategy hold for somebody who says, I want to stop this merry-go-round and you know, rearrange the horses here?
Right. So I would characterize it, you know, it's still the same threat list as the last administration, right? The Obama administration, it's the big five, of course, China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, and global CTOps, counterterrorism. But this defense strategy, written by Secretary Mattis, proved foot stomped by Secretary Esper, prioritizes the big five threat list even further, which the last administration did not want to do. And I can see the political reasons why nobody wants to do that. It's just that's dicey when you start to try and put counterterrorism lower on the list. Americans get nervous. I understand. But this defense strategy, clearly, I've described it as China is first among equals. It's China is the pacing threat. It's the pacing threat for the department, just generally speaking, but also the secret docs, right? The O plan, the operational plans, the war plans, the campaign plans, all the plans. It's now that doesn't mean there aren't separate plans for other contingencies involving the other countries that I've mentioned. But when I say the pacing threat, it's meaning that is what the services are essentially instructed to organize, train, and equip around. So you have this big force to do what? Well, to win the competition, and if competition fails, to win the war against China. So that's and of course competition is so many, many, many things. But you can quickly see where the defense strategy, it's easy when you're in a defense environment, you know, that we're all thinking about every day and you're working in that swirl, that it seems as if the Defense Department then is sort of the lead agency for competition, when I actually don't think that at all. I see competition where, and this is where, you know, a secondary task or sort of objective of Esper when he was secretary, to get at your question, he wanted to preserve readiness for this competition, right? Preserve, or I should say, free up time for the force to then reorient, you know, the things that they're doing wherever they are in the world. You know, again, I talk about like time in the schoolhouse, time in the maintenance yard or motor pool or wherever, you know, changing the daily tasks, everyone, the civilians too, in the department to ultimately get there. That's a huge ocean liner to turn, right? We all know that. That was a very ambitious goal. I think he probably got the ball to the 50-yard line, though, which is pretty, that's pretty significant for a short tenure such as his. I mean, not short, but, you know, under 2 years. And that's the ultimate goal. He was seeking irreversible implementation of the defense strategy. It would have taken another 2 years, I think, to do that. And I'm not even referencing all of the, you know, changed investments in the defense budget itself that he also oversaw, which the last administration again started. But I'm not sure, you know, I don't have a sense for how, for example, the combatant commanders interpreted that guidance, right? So much of the department's work is, you know, behind public eyes and viewing and the scenes, because it's classified for good reason. And a lot of the tasks that we're talking about are classified when they're associated with certain plans. But as we've been talking about here, what I'm seeing are tasks that aren't associated with any plan. And this is where I quickly wanted to get to this sort of definition creep, which has very real-world consequences of this term or concept of presence. And I talk about, and I mean, no service knows this better than the Navy. The Navy's 100 ships smaller. I mean, you guys know this, right? The GAO constantly has been beating the drum. The Navy's 100 ships smaller today than at the start of the century, and they're just as busy, exactly the same. Nothing has changed in terms of sort of essentially operational tempo. That's shocking, right? And what is the I mean, granted, there were significant and serious conflicts in between, but a lot of the work, for example, right now, and again, that Sam and Megan alluded to, that it's in this basket of presence. And it's so many things to so many people. And I'm worried the combatant commanders can just say, well, it's for good reason for presence. And then nobody gets to sort of push back on that. And that's really an area where if we're going to have to start to neck down and get more specific about the problem so that you can address the problem, I think that, and that's where you get, again, at the roles and missions. Okay, presence, right? So presence for what? Is it helping do those other objectives that I talked about achieve them from the defense strategy or not? Because presence can quickly become the term where it means whatever the commander wants it to mean. It's in the eye of the beholder kind of thing, and then it's hard to not conduct oversight, but it's hard to push back.
I mean, you're right. Navalists, we know presence. But I think in some ways the concept and the terminology of presence, I don't know if it's been warped in a way, because part of presence, as I've seen it, has always been, I'll just pick a random country because that's what I do. Lebanon. Hey, 2 weeks ago, the Americans showed up here with a carrier and four ships, and they headed off and do other things. Boy, they can come over here quite often. And then a few weeks later, we do the same thing off of Tunisia. But we don't go to Lebanon and drop anchor for 6 months in a row. You can do presence without much of a footprint if you do it right. And I don't know why, maybe I'm the problem, but I don't understand why this is such a hard sell, because it wasn't for previous generations. But I want to tie in a couple things that we've talked about here. That is presence, risk, and readiness. Readiness is a consumable or a commodity. You can consume it, you can use it, and in some ways you can store it and reserve it. And when you have readiness reserved, you can do things like surge for the unexpected national security crisis, which, by the way, is almost all of them. Nobody really predicts things in a way that you can plan for them. So by having a little bit of a banked reserve, which is known as a properly husbanded and cared for force, they can respond to that. But as opposed to focusing on that, especially everybody talks about big power competition, well, it takes a lot of readiness in order to be able to respond to that effectively. It's almost as if we suffer from a national security version of attention deficit disorder, where this is broken above the background noise and is the headlines, and we have to deploy X and Y in order to stop it. And we do that, would it have stopped anyway? Maybe, maybe not. So we keep accepting risk for the big fight, the big risk, by avoiding the small risk, which is deploying these little units. Am I reading that right? Why is that adoption of, we'll take the, we saw this especially in Westpac in 2017, we'll take the risk for the big fight because we don't want to take the risk for the small deployments.
That is exactly the trend I am seeing. And I believe you've said it better than I thought it. It's one of the reasons I wanted to pen this article and do the research, figure out what I could behind it. That, and again, this is where Secretary Esper, I think he wanted to get to that new model. So exactly what you just said, you know, preserve, build, maintain, all the different verbs, whatever you need to do, depending on what it is we're talking about, right? So let's say it's readiness for the competition, the long-term competition, and less of the day-to-day scramble. You know, the urge to do something now is always there. As Eagle One said, the department loves to salute quickly, snap its heels, and say, can do. But thoughtful leaders need to step back and see what's happening because of that, right? So, I mean, if Megan and Sam's article didn't scare us all, I mean, we're not ready for the near-term fight or the long-term competition, much less the long-term fight, based on the churn. And I'm not saying we go to zero and pull up stakes and everyone comes to, you know, here and twiddle their thumbs back home. That's not at all what I'm saying. There's a lot of good things to do forward. There's a lot of exercises that would still need to continue, but I am, it's just easy. It's the easy answer. Oh, something happened, send some, you know, send this small unit, send that small group, send that group, send this, you know, brigade, or even this company. Show the flag, be there. Even if we're not doing anything, as you point out, in some cases we are, and in some cases we aren't. Others, and you can even argue other times when we get involved, we're making it worse. In fact, that's kind of what a lot of researchers are saying right now about our involvement in Syria, that we actually made it worse, and we made the killing significantly more worse of Syrian civilians as a result of our sort of, you know, 8% involvement or whatever, however you want to classify it. It's not a laughing matter by any means, but, you know, we can't seem to figure out, to turn the telescope, so to speak, and figure this out more thoughtfully and earnestly, I guess, with senior policymakers. I mean, I remember, I keep picking on this flotilla, the Southern Command, that President Trump asked for in April, because to me, you know, it was, you know, we're using torpedoes and hellfires against, you know, drug runners, when that's a total waste of resources, right? You don't need that excessive force. And when, you know, the P-8s and the AWACS and the things that went with it, this group, the other assets from all, even the Air Force sent, you know, different types of ISR and other capabilities. But it was just shocking. And I just keep pointing out when people say, you know, well, what's an example of just saying no, for example, restraining the urge to do something, the instinct to always act? That was one of my examples. You know, that was, to me, something where we probably should have spent that time differently for everybody who was involved in that operation.
Yeah, I listened to Sal, and I thought, well, you know, this reminds me of Dave Ramsey, that financial guy, who always talking about building up an emergency fund. You know, what do you do, just to put it in the sense of our daily, our citizens, you know, what do you do to protect yourself against downturns or emergencies? You build up this emergency fund. And then when your roof fails or your air conditioning blows up or whatever, your car dies by the side of the road, you've got this emergency fund. Or as Sal put it, you've got a surge force that you can send. And we've done that in the past because we had the luxury of having, I don't know, 15, 20 carriers floating around. I mean, I remember being off Vietnam and all of a sudden we had carriers out the yin yang when we were trying to mine the harbors of Haiphong. So, you know, but those days, and I always wonder about this, is the fact that we have fairly old people who are my age, maybe a little younger than me, who had experience when we had these big Navy or big Army or big Air Force, does that color their thinking, that do they not know that the asset pool now is a lot more limited than it was in those days, that it may be higher quality in many ways, but we don't have as many, you can only have one ship in one place at one time. And that is a constraint that I'm not sure, does Congress understand this? Do they care? Or do they just want somebody to go cheery aye aye and go sailing off of whatever's at hand?
I tend to think it's cheery aye aye, but I don't, but that's my point on the sort of take a step back, take a deep breath. Where are the people looking across the whole issue and the whole problem, the whole enterprise? And so, right. So when we go back to the start of the conversation about, you know, the Army, Navy and Air Force examples of burning out man and machine as fast as we can get them out of boot camp and, you know, out of the, you know, on the flight line or whatever term is, launching them off in to do something somewhere to solve a problem supposedly, and not preserve this sort of, right, this, you know, break in case of emergency capability. Now, I get it. That might be sort of antiquated way of thinking, because particularly as the military, exactly to your point, has become smaller, it becomes really hard to sort of cordon off certain capabilities and skill sets, especially when readiness is, in most cases, as said, quite perishable. But we know that the way we're doing it now isn't working, right? So we know that ships that spend too much time at sea have exhausted crews, right? We know that exhausted crews can, we keep talking about 2017 for good reason, right? So one of the sailors on board one of the ships that collided said, you know, you lose that instinct and concern to ships passing too close to you because they were so tired and overworked and, you know, thinking, oh, the other guy, you know, the other person's got this. I can, you know, go do this over here. Like, that's really real, right? And there were real-world consequences. I call the 2017 collisions like our modern-day Task Force Smith. If that wasn't enough to wake up Washington to look more broadly beyond the Navy, although I do think the Navy is the most uniquely and devastatingly affected by this term, constant need to be in motion for military forces that are active duty. Whether or not that's the right thing is what I mean by that, of course. And, you know, I would like to say, like, when Sal and I were talking on email and Twitter, I want your listeners to know this. I work at a think tank and it's my job and everything, but I don't pretend to think that anyone reads anything I write. I try and get it in front of the right people, but, you know, it's rare where an article gets this much attention, meaning where people reach out to me directly about it, about this combatant commander demand signal diet. And I've heard from people all over the world. And you know what's interesting is that it's mostly field grade officer level. And that's not even a little surprising, is it? Because who am I not hearing from? People at the Pentagon. And those are the people who I actually usually hear from on anything I write. And in this case, I'm hearing from everyone else, and it's crickets over at the department. And, I mean, I heard from an F-22 squadron commander in Asia Pacific. And I heard from, I don't want to get too specific because I didn't ask permission from all these people, but, you know, the Navy Russia guy. I heard from the Navy War Room Admiral for the NDS in the building. I can go on and on, but there's all this, like, fan mail of feedback. It's not fan. Not everybody has, you know, kind words about it. But that's unusual. That, to me, as I told Sal, this either hit a nerve or struck a chord or both in some cases, and that there's really something there. And we really need to figure it out because that's, you know, I live in Washington. Like, it's making the rounds. And I think that's really interesting for us to think about. Why did this topic touch off thought and reaction by so many people?
Yeah, I think you hit on it right there with the, and I'm not surprised that you got the reaction that you have from the field grade officers, because some of the communications I had with folks, they're the ones that are living it. They are the ones that have to make it work. They're the ones that see the impact on their sailors, Marines, soldiers, airmen, and Coast Guardsmen. You know, the classic E4 married with two kids, with a third on the way that's been home the last 365 days. 25 of them between workups, deployment, classes, and other assignments. So it's not surprising that's the ones, and I hate to sound like that guy, but there's some people that have been in D.C. for too long. It's been too long since they've deployed, and they kind of lose touch on that. And, you know, you talk about around the world, and I think a lot of times we do what we're doing because on paper it looks like we can, but we have some allies there's a lot of things they can't do because on paper, even on paper, they can't. And it's hard because we're so large compared to all of our allies, but there are some mini-me's out there that are similar to us both in quality, quantity, and culture. And I've wondered if you've had an opportunity to look it's some of our friends and allies and the decision processes they make and how they prioritize things that if not impress, at least interested you.
Yes. Not for this article in particular, but over the years I have. And I will quickly say you're exactly right. It's those who are living the results of the decisions made by people much higher than them are the ones reacting to this exact article. And that's entirely true. It's remarkable. And the question is, will they be heard? Second is, you know, the more I think about this and I think about what can we stop doing? You know, what can we give permission to everyone to stop doing? You quickly become, you know, I become my internal Robert Gates. And what I mean that by that, I want a strong State Department. I want a strong every other federal agency to be able to do their jobs and whatever their core expertise as well. Same with allies and partners. Everybody else needs to do what they do well, and we need to let them do it well, as in we, the Department of Defense, so that in other ways, not even linked to the combatant commander, that DOD can stop or pull back or do slightly less of something somewhere. You know, I've been struck by a number of allies and their processes, like, for example, Australia and how they come to put out their white papers and the Brits and others where they have shadow positions where oftentimes they have shared positions where like three people have one job, so to speak. And Let's say like one goes on maternity leave, the other one steps in, and you know, there, I can give you many more examples, and I don't want to go long, but yes, there's a lot we can learn from these other models and that we could potentially bring in terms of decision-making in particular. There's other things, position, et cetera. But our friends, we should not be so full of hubris as to think that we have nothing left to learn from them. There's so much more to learn.
And that, Mackenzie, thank you for coming back on the show. Obviously, we need to have you back more frequently because, you know, A, it's a lot of fun, and B, you know a lot of the stuff that we really need to talk about. But let me ask you this as we're getting ready to say goodbye to you. What have you got in the mill other than this Admiral No or whatever the name of your article is going to – next article for War on the Rocks is going to be? And what can we look forward to, and where can people find your work?
Great. Yeah. So all of it's at AEI.org, but, you know, I also publish elsewhere. Yeah. So what's next is, you know, it's interesting. I'm going to attack another orthodoxy, which I hope you'll appreciate. So everywhere I look, whether that's the DNC platform, whether it's the House Bipartisan Future of Defense Task Force, whether it's people who could be the next Secretary of Defense and everyone in between, there's this mantra out there, right, that we can cut legacy weapon systems to buy the future. Essentially new technology. And, you know, I'm hearing everyone is so certain of being right about this that I immediately have my radar go up that this can't be, that something is wrong. You know, and so I'm doing a bigger project. I have, you know, one article out on this, but, you know, invention and innovation are not the same thing. The Pentagon's not the inventor anymore, so we have to be the innovator. And where do we need to innovate? Well, we need to use a lot of legacy systems as technological playgrounds. And so I'm gonna dig deeper into that. Stay tuned.
Well, that sounds great, Mackenzie, and I kind of like the way you're thinking in that direction. And again, I really appreciate you coming on and look forward to the next opportunity to talk.
Thank you for having me, and thanks to everyone for joining us and who's listening in. I appreciate it.
Well, it's been our pleasure. Thanks, Mackenzie.
And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidWraps. Hope everybody has a great Thanksgiving, however big or small it may be. And until next time, I hope everybody has a great Navy day. Cheers.
Molly wrote a neat reply to Irish Paddy Old, saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly.